Come on aboard, I promise you. There's lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Hey there, and welcome into another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
I'm Lisa Braltz.
I'm Travis Tate.
Wait, what?
I'm not John Steinbecker.
No, John Steinbecker. He packed up. Cubs won the pennant. He said, "I'm going to Disney World." So he's
and
down in
we're
Orlando.
Not kidding. He actually went to Disney World.
And he packed up
he's
everything
right
he's
now.
Got. He literally lives there, from what I understand.
Yeah.
There's
He'll
a nice
be
picture
back.
Of John on Facebook with a Jawa from
oh,
Star
I
Wars.
I missed that. Yeah. I missed that. Wow. So he really did go to Disney World. So this week, Travis has agreed to come in and not just talk a little bit about basketball, but to hang out with us for the whole hour. So thank you, Travis.
I'm here.
It's really
thank
nice
you for
of
having
you.
Me.
Yeah. It's really nice of you. So what's the plan today, guys?
Well, we've got a lot of good things on tap. We'll check in with Jill Gengler, our resident diehard Cubs fan, to see how she's faring after last night's Game 1 of the World Series.
I hope she's okay.
Yeah, I hope so. As for me, I'm just sleepy.
Yeah, I mean, I hope you're okay, too. But
Yeah, I stayed up and watched it and got about 4 hours of sleep. And so I'm sleepy, but I'm still confident. I think the Cubs have a good chance to come back and win the series, despite losing Game 1 of that last night. But we'll hear from Jill here in just a little bit. We're going to talk a little NBA hoops with Travis Tate here. We'll talk about some of the area teams in the Midwest and surrounding areas and some other basketball things as well. We'll also talk a little bit about the Star Spangled Banner and some of the ongoing protests that athletes have been doing, kneeling and other things during the anthem. We will have a rivalry. Travis will bring the rivalry to the table this week.
Yeah, make the new guy do it. That's what we decide. Make the new guy.
I can
do
it. You got to challenge the new guy.
Baptism by fire, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
So we'll have that coming up. And, of course, our usual social media nonsense. And I see a new name for that segment on the rundown this week. Are we trying something different?
I think I want to call it Status Update.
Status Update?
Mm-hmm.
All right,
that's
fair
what
enough.
They are.
Yeah, right.
And I was trying to think of something really clever using a hashtag. I was just like, forget it. It's a status update.
Status update.
I've got mine. I hope you guys have yours, and I hope we don't all have the same one.
I doubt that.
Right.
I know. What are the odds?
John has stolen mine before.
Well, see, and I think because we follow a lot of the same people or entities, so I think it's possible, but
it is possible.
Unlikely.
All right. Very good. So coming up next, we'll check in with Jill Gengler, our resident diehard Cubs fan. So stay with us. That's up next here on the Bandwagon.
Hey, hey, holy mackerel, no doubt about it, the Cubs are on their way.
Hey, hey.
Okay, so now is the part of our podcast where we check in with Jill Gengler. And as at the time of this recording, the Cubs are in the World Series. Yay. But they lost 6-0 to the Indians in the first game of the World Series last night. Boo. So we thought we would check in with Jill and see how she's doing. So thanks for joining us today, Jill.
Hi, everybody. I'm still here.
You're still here. So do you have anything to add to that, to just still being
That's
here?
Really about the best I could hope for at this point. So I'm still here.
Okay. So I actually have a question for both you and Brian, which is about in the previous episode of the podcast, we talked about there was just so much anticipation and excitement and about just winning the pennant. So that was achieved, and there was much happiness and joy in our building here at WILL with all the Cubs fans, and I'm sure in your household and many, many other households. Now, what does it feel like being in the World Series? Is the feeling the same? I guess my question is, was the anticipation of winning the pennant greater than the anticipation of potentially winning the World Series for you?
For me, no.
Okay.
I feel like last year, after we beat the Cardinals, it was like, all right, that's good enough. Anything else is just gravy, but beating the Cardinals was really job one, and things after that were, I don't want to say less important, but that was really the big, mountain to climb for me. This year, though, it's all up, it's all looking up. It's all great. I'm so excited. I was like vibrating yesterday. I was so excited. The GAs, my grad assistants had to tell me to like calm down at some point. Like, you know, they took away my coffee type of excitement. So I'm on board. I'm ready to go.
Okay. What about you, Brian?
Yeah, I think all the talk about the curse and that for the Cubs all goes back to this whole Billy Goat nonsense in 1945. So for me, once they got that done, you know, they made the World Series, which was what the curse thing was all about anyway. I'm like, all right, cool. They're in the World Series, and obviously I hope they win. I think they're a better team than Cleveland. But I'm confident that if they don't win the World Series this year, they're going to be a very good team for the next few seasons and will likely have more chances to get back here and win a title.
So what about the nickname Lovable Losers? Do you think that's gone forever?
Yes.
So even if they lose this World Series?
Yes.
And do you think that's a good thing that it's gone? I mean, I feel like Chicago's image of itself as a city is somewhat predicated on the Cubs not being very good.
That's fine. I'm not from Chicago, so I don't care.
Okay. I'm just checking. I mean, it's actually something that I'm kind of interested in is, like, is this paradigm shift that's going to happen, especially if they win, which, don't get me wrong, I'm all for it. But I'm curious to know, you know, does that suddenly elevate Chicago back up in sports status to, like, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago? Everybody, you know, we've all won World Series. It seems like baseball is kind of that last thing.
So I don't know. As far as that goes, I think definitely the Cubs right now are kind of nationally, you know, the team that people are rooting for. But I think if what I think is going to happen happens over the next few seasons, where the Cubs are good every year and they're in the playoffs every year and they win a World Series or two, they're quickly going to become kind of like the Red Sox and a team that people are tired of seeing in the playoffs every year.
Interesting. Travis, do you have anything to add to this conversation?
Yeah.
I don't even know your status as a Cubs fan.
Well, he's a Cardinals fan.
Oh, whoops.
So
sorry.
Yeah. I was going to go back to Jill, and you said how excited, and I forget that you said you were kind of buzzing.
Vibrating
mm-hmm. throughout the day yesterday. How does that compare to, because as Brian mentioned, the Cubs have been a favorite all year. They won, 105 games or so, 103. How does that compare with the 2003 and maybe the couple seasons after that when, again, they were expected to be good for a number of years coming, you know, in a row with Pryor and Zambrano and all those other guys? How does this year's expectations compare with the 2003 expectations?
Really, I'm at a different point in my life right now. 2003 was when I had my first child. So while I was watching sports, I wasn't focused on sports. So it's really hard for me to make a valid comparison because I wasn't as tuned in then as I am right now.
Yeah, as far as 2003 goes, I mean, that season, that postseason, is probably one of the most painful memories of any Cubs fan, if you were following it closely. For me, 2003 fit right in with 1984, which was really my first big Cubs memory, was that season. You know, first playoff berth in almost 40 years, 2-0 lead on the Padres and losing that series, in part because the National League would not give the Cubs home field advantage because they didn't have lights.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
The final three games of that series were all played in San Diego. But anyway, so those two memories were pretty painful. And I think one of the differences between 03 and now, the 03 team was kind of, they had the young pitching, which, as we've seen in a lot of cases, young pitching can get injured. We saw that with the Mets this year. They had the young staff last year that was so good and got them to the World Series. And at least half of that rotation, I think three-fourths of that rotation, was hurt when they got to the postseason this year. I think the difference now is the Cubs have built around young position players who are less likely to be injured and knocked out for long periods of time. The pitchers they have, for the most part, are guys who have been tested. And you have a pretty good idea that their arms are going to hold up because they've proven it over time. So I think in terms of long-term competitiveness, I like where this team is better than back in 03.
Do you think you would have thought that even at the time?
I don't think necessarily.
Everyone
always
says pitching, you know, pitching wins essentially. Pitching definitely wins in the playoffs. And you look at that 0-3 team and you must be thinking, oh my gosh, we've got three studs.
Yeah, I certainly was at the time. I think, you know, there were some warning signs if you look back at it. Kerry Wood in particular had already missed a full season with elbow surgery. Mark Pryor at that time was in his first full season. And I think you thought about pitchers a little bit differently even then. We were only talking 13 years ago than you do now. I don't think there's any way that Mark Pryor in his first full season now would have thrown, you know, 220-plus innings in his first full season and gone, you know, 130-plus pitches several times down the stretch of that season. So, you know, could he have still gotten hurt? Absolutely. He still could have gotten hurt. But I think the paradigm of the way teams think about that has changed a little bit.
So, Jill, I have another question for you just about the mood in your household and and how what your plan is moving forward throughout the World Series. I mean, nobody has ever planned to watch a Cubs World Series before. So are you doing anything different or special? How is your spouse holding up and your kids? What are your plans for the coming days?
Well, we're doing okay. It's a unique situation because we've never had baseball clash up against like Halloween commitments before. So I'm suddenly having to balance the fact that like my kids have trunk or treat at their school tonight, and because they've moved up the time of the game to avoid rain in Cleveland, you know, it's like, what do? We promised the kids they can go dress up and go see their friends. And now it's like this weird balancing act of, okay, which parent is going to be the one to take the kids? Or are we both going to go and equally miss parts of the Cubs game? We haven't had that conversation yet, and the clock is ticking. So that's a new kind of conflict that we're going to have to negotiate. Or the fact that we were supposed to go to an adult Halloween kind of party this weekend, and now my husband and I are like, okay, we're putting in an appearance and we're taking off because there's probably going to be a game that night. So.
Very, very funny that you would mention that, because over the weekend, Travis and I happened to be at the same wedding of a colleague of ours, and on every table, I would say, during dinner, somebody's phone was streaming the Cubs game. And even the people... let's just say there are people who probably shouldn't have been watching the game who were watching the game, and I don't think anybody cared. So it's interesting that you would say that. I mean, people were, you know, I was kind of wondering about this wedding. When they're playing the wedding, who was thinking that maybe the Cubs would be, you know, in a pennant race? So I think I can sort of understand your plight.
And the bride, notably, is a Cardinals fan.
I bet. No, okay.
Planning on the Cardinals being potentially.
We'll have to ask her about that when she gets back. Yeah. So it sounds like, though, despite all of these new wrinkles, the mood in the house is pretty good.
We are solid. We are good. It's the same feeling we had in that Dodgers series where, you know, we lost those two games in a row and there was like, you know, what's going to happen? Are we, you know, just not showing up for the series? And then all of a sudden the Cubs just turned it around. You know, you trust in your players, you trust in the manager, and they just, you know, lit that thing on fire. So we're just waiting on the Cubs. You know, they're going to light it on fire again. We just know it.
Hey, Jill, this is Travis. I wanted to ask even more specifically, I guess, about your setup for watching the game at home. We've all done this, but In games that are this important to you, do you have things that you do, things that you don't do? Are you one of these people who needs to get up at every, you know, between inning and clean something? Or do you have to sit there and watch every second of every commercial and every pitch? Or take me through what the process was like last night.
So we we have an interesting tech setup because we're cable cutters. And so we're, you know, negotiating this. Now we have the antenna to pick up Fox, but Fox is the weakest signal at our house.
Ditto.
So,
yeah,
same.
You know, yeah. So my husband at the last minute is trying to like position our, you know, we have an antenna in the house. He's trying to find the right spot for it. We're eating dinner in front of the TV. Dinner's finished. We've got all the dirty dishes, have to get ready for tomorrow. And I don't really care for the national announcers anyway. And it doesn't, I'm not bad-mouthing necessarily the Fox announcers for last night. I just generally prefer the Chicago announcers. So So I really like to get up and clean in the kitchen and have the score 670 on. I've got the MLB app, so I can tune in via the radio that way. And it's just, it's much more calming for me to have something to do with my hands and listen to Pat and Ron on the radio. Baseball for me is a radio sport. So I just really prefer to have them on and have something kind of busy I can do. Eventually I do settle down and go and sit and watch TV, but I still have got my headphones on and I'm listening to Pat and Ron. I'm not trying to listen to whatever random people they have on the television.
Well, good luck to you and to all of the other stressed out Cubs fans out there. We're sitting with one right now. John, of course, is not here with us, but I can practically feel him through the internet. So good luck, and thank you so much for agreeing to talk with us about your feelings.
Thanks, everybody. Go Cubs. We're doing great.
Thanks, Jill.
The Chicago Cubs are on their way.
Let's get this ball rolling, so to speak, with some NBA hoops. And Travis, you're kind of our NBA expert here. So what do we want to talk about here?
I guess I just wanted to bring up to area sports fans, I suppose it's sort of a notice to everybody, how many teams there are that are actually in the Midwest. You don't really typically think of the Midwest as a big NBA, I don't know, part of the country. You think maybe more of like an East Coast thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a bunch of teams around here, including the entire Eastern Conference Central Division, which includes the Chicago Bulls. But then outside of those five teams, there's also Memphis, which is about 5 or 6 hours down the road. There's Minnesota, which is up in Lisa's part of the country. Oklahoma City isn't that far away, and they sort of have an interesting team, and then that's all in addition to Milwaukee, and you know Milwaukee's only about three or four hours away. There's Indiana in Indianapolis that's about 2 hours, so all these teams are really close. Cleveland is obviously great, and Detroit is just up the road as well. So I sort of wanted to bring attention to all the teams that are in the area, and everybody's got different storylines of what's going on, but many of those teams, you know, everybody sort of knows that Cleveland is going to be good. They just played last night. They actually moved up the time of the very first game of the NBA season got moved up because of the, I'm phrasing it in different terms here, the Indians game as opposed to the Cubs game, regardless of the World Series. But they had those two things going on at the same time in downtown Cleveland, so that was definitely a big night for them. The Cavs came out and won the game pretty easily. And they should be very, very good. Everyone is sort of expecting them to make the NBA Finals again. They are more than likely going to play the Golden State Warriors again. This will be the third year in a row, which I believe has actually never happened, not even with the Lakers and the Celtics in the 80s or any of the Bulls championships or any of even the earlier Celtics teams. I guess they had to have played the Lakers three times in a row, maybe in like the 60s, but that's...
Yeah, maybe in the 60s.
Pre-merger.
Yeah. Right.
Pre-ABA-NBA merger, so that's a little different. So anyway, those two teams are going to be the story the entire year. There's certainly other little storylines based on people's contracts and players that have moved and coaches that have moved and things, but those are going to be the two big teams.
So I have a question about this Midwestern sort of unknown bastion of basketball, maybe not power, although there are some very, very good teams here. Why do you think that perception is there, that the Midwest is not really a place for professional basketball? I mean, when I think to college conferences, I think a lot of the East Coast and South teams from the South kind of get a lot of the attention and the airtime, and maybe, and you know, the Big Ten does too, although I don't think nearly as much as some of these other conferences. Do you think it's sort of the same idea there?
I do think that in college, the Big Ten does have a bigger impact than maybe sort of your impression of it is, just because the size of the schools here in the Big Ten are so big. You know, every school here is 40,000, basically. Michigan State's huge. Ohio State's huge. We're huge. So, but I do get what you're saying, though. There is a little more of this, like, glitz and glamour, the
exactly
Washington, D.C., Boston, New York City side of things, Philadelphia side of things, just kind of dominates in professional sports. Plus, in pro sports, there's a much bigger deal placed on the West Coast, I think, than there is in college. The Lakers are, you know, the biggest brand in the NBA, one of the biggest brands in all of professional sports in the world, and so they're just a big deal. The teams in the Midwest that aren't getting a whole lot of play, maybe the last 10 years in the NBA, those relationships might change based on really great teams that come through. Minnesota is expected to be very, very good in the next, like, 10 years, starting maybe as soon as this year. They have a bunch of really young guys and have a lot of expectations in the next couple of years. A good example of that is Oklahoma City. I mean, that was sort of a very random place to drop an NBA team, but because they had really great players and a really great team, they're, you know, one of the most popular teams in the entire league. So it's just dependent upon players, in my view. And Milwaukee has some young talent. Minnesota has some young talent. Indiana will probably be good again. So, and Cleveland just won the title, so maybe there will be more expectations and sort of spotlights shining in the Midwest.
Yeah, I think for a lot of the Midwest teams, it really takes, I think, a really deep playoff run or maybe a finals appearance for them to really get onto the map. And it's been a while, other than Oklahoma City, you know, it's been a while since the team kind of in the middle of the country, other than Cleveland, has had a deep run. I mean, well, Milwaukee hasn't been to the finals, I don't think, since the days of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar when they won a title back in the 70s.
Yep.
Detroit really hasn't, you know, they had their good teams about 10 years ago with Larry Brown where they rose up and won a title, but they've been pretty bad since then. And so that's kind of what I think it takes for those teams in the middle of the country to get the publicity is a really deep playoff run, especially a finals appearance.
And sort of going with your point that you brought up a good example with that Detroit team, maybe a Midwest team, and maybe I'm just sort of assigning what people think of the Midwest onto their basketball teams, but you might have to have multiple very good players on a team as opposed to one really big superstar on a team, which is exactly what that Detroit team had. They had basically five all-stars in their starting lineup as opposed to a LeBron James type of player on their team. And so maybe that's what Milwaukee will have going on. Minnesota is a little bit different because they have a guy who could potentially be one of the five best players in the league or something, Karl-Anthony Towns. He'll be in his second year this year, and he's just blowing up the interwebs, as they say.
I think it's interesting, this perception of the Midwest as a brand, not even necessarily in sports, but it's flyover country, nobody cares.
Yeah.
And then here we've got this, like, sort of massive but still accessible cluster of teams that probably maybe don't command as high of ticket prices maybe as on either coast.
True.
And that way people can, if they really need to get their Lakers fix and they, you know, they live in Milwaukee or Cleveland, they can do that. So I just think that's why I was asking, is it's more, I think there's this perception of the Midwest as being, and a lot of these teams are like rust belty, you know,
Memphis,
perceived as being more blue collar and not nearly as sexy as some of these East Coast teams. And so so I think that's part of the brand and the optics, as they say, of what that looks like. But maybe that idea is changing.
And I'll bring up one more thing kind of about that Rust Belt area. So Memphis, they're in the NBA world, they're known for their grit and grind, which is like an attitude. And it's been a motto and it's been a catchphrase for 6 or 7 or 8 years now. And that really sort of manifests itself in the way they brand their team and in the way that they actually play on the floor. They're very gritty. They're not very flashy. But then again, they did just sign their point guard to the highest contract in the history of the NBA. So that's sort of a strange thing to have happened. But the more recent piece of news that might involve the Rust Belt could be that if the NBA decides to expand based on their new collective bargaining agreement, there is sort of general thought in the NBA Twitterverse that Seattle would get a team because they have a ultra-rich guy who badly wants to bring the Sonics back to Seattle. They, of course, escape to OKC a number of years ago. But then you have an unbalanced league, and so the thought is, could there be a 31st team but also a 32nd team? And where would that 32nd team be? So what I've seen, a sort of leading name is Louisville, which I think is an interesting place.
Wow.
Namely because they already have an arena. That's like the number one.
The Yum Center.
The Yum Center. It's got an exclamation point in there, too. Don't forget
the
that.
The Yum Center?
Yum awesome. Is like the company, I think, that owns all the
KFC
and yeah. Taco Bell that's, and all those things.
That's kind of an awesome name.
So it's sort of an interesting place, I think, for an NBA team to go just because, like you mentioned, it's kind of flyover country. It's in Kentucky of all places. Like you don't typically think of Louisville as a really big city that is sort of deserving
of. But it's
of,
a basketball town.
Agreed. Yeah.
And they did have the Kentucky Colonels of the ABA.
Were they in Louisville?
I think they were. I can't remember if they were Louisville or Lexington, if they played in Lexington because they had an arena at University
but
of Kentucky.
But regardless, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah. Then the Colonels were one of the more successful ABA franchises, but when it came time for the merger, that the league just didn't think the market could sustain it. So it'd be interesting to see if they do in fact move into Louisville.
Yeah, yeah. And then everyone gets to determine how they say
exactly
Louisville or Louisville.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the women's NBA, just because we just had a final. There was, as the British would say, controversy in that game. And we can talk about that in a second. But I want to, first of all, come out and say I barely watched any of it. And I am a huge proponent of women's basketball. I played basketball. I love basketball. I want people to watch women's basketball. I did not watch a single bloody game in its entirety. And I am ashamed. And I want to know why this is. And I think for me, although I don't have this reaction with women's soccer, is I really get depressed when I see so few people like at the games watching. There's something subconscious that happens to me where I'm just like, maybe I just won't watch this game. Now, it doesn't happen to me so much in women's soccer. Sometimes you watch the women's pro games and there's maybe 1,000 people at these games, which really doesn't look like very much, especially in a big stadium. But I want to know why. I want to know why. I want this sport. They have amazing players. The game is amazing. It is not even close to the game it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's way better.
It is, well, depending on how you judge better. To me, it's different. Are we saying they play more like men? Are men the standard that we're measuring them against? I just think it's more athletic. It's more fun to watch. It's smarter. It's grittier. It has changed a lot. But why am I not watching it? Why aren't you guys watching it?
I know why I'm not watching it.
Okay.
Two reasons. One, like for instance, there was the deciding game of that WNBA final was on the same night as a Cubs playoff game.
Okay, fair enough, for sure.
There's no way I was slipping over to that during a Cubs playoff game.
Totally taken.
The other part of it is for me that the WNBA plays in the summer, basically, and their playoffs come in the fall. So, I mean, baseball is my main sport in general, and so for me, it's really hard for me to get geared up for basketball during baseball season. That'd be the case even, honestly, for the NBA for me. I don't follow the NBA that much to begin with, but if it were in the summer during baseball season, I would really never watch it.
I totally agree. I was going to bring up two things. One is absolutely the schedule. I think playing in the summer is just sort of strange, I guess, for a sport like basketball.
I mean, I know why they do it.
High school and college are always... They play in the typical seasons, but you know why they do it. But
yeah, because they're affiliated with NBA franchises, or at least they were. I don't know if that relationship is still there.
Some of them are. I think the Sparks and some other. I'm not totally
positive. And they still play in the NBA arenas, and so the NBA arenas are free in the spring and summer. And so I know that that's why they tend to that's why they have the season when they do, but. For me, it's just hard to get geared up during the summer.
Yeah, I think the summer thing is a big deal. And then I think the other one is that, for me at least, it's just that I never got started in the first place. Hmm. And so I'm not going to, I guess, just pick it up this year when I haven't done it before. So I have to have a reason to get started, I guess, that very first time. And that has just personally never happened with me. Maybe some great player will come along and, maybe I should be a big Breanna Stewart fan and just watch all of her games or something. But that's the kind of thing I think it takes is I got to get in first and then you'll be able to keep me. But how do I get in?
Yeah. No. It's interesting to me that as a player, as a former player, I can be so affected by perceptions of women's basketball from the outside, or the lack of crowd, or the relative lack of crowd. Now, when I was in Minnesota last fall, the Lynx were in the finals last fall as well, and the bar was full of people who were not leaving until whatever game – it was not a final game that I was at, that, until that game was over. Mm-hmm. And there was a baseball game on too. I can't remember who was playing at that point, but no one was watching that. Everybody was watching the Lynx. So I think part of it is location too. I mean, we've got the U of I women's basketball team here and countless high school teams that we could watch, but we don't have that pro component.
Yeah.
Nearby.
And it is kind of fun. I always think it's super interesting how much they have to acknowledge the power of women's college basketball by having a team in Connecticut. I've always thought that that's super interesting. That's unlike anything else anywhere else.
Same thing
else,
happened
really.
In soccer, though. I mean, Western New York has a soccer team because that's where Abby Wambach was from, the Flash. And so you always, like, New York City doesn't have one,
right.
But Western New York does. So it's interesting. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up. But let's talk about this call that basically lost the championship for the Minnesota Lynx.
Yeah, apparently there was a shot clock issue where the officials did not call a shot clock violation on Los Angeles, if I'm remembering that correctly. And because of that, their game-winning basket counted when maybe it shouldn't have. And the Lynx really didn't have much of a chance to counter that.
And this is one of those... And they couldn't challenge it? Did they not challenge it?
I don't know what the replay system is in the WNBA.
I don't either.
I really don't know what the system is there.
In this article that we had on a saved list that probably none of us read, I didn't read until just now, it says, the referees initially signaled for a review, but since play continued, they were unable to change the result at the next stoppage. Lynx coach Cheryl Reeve ripped the WNBA and the officials immediately after the game. So again, it would be had. So this was basically human error. This had nothing, and it was like logistics within the game. It had
right.
nothing to do with like the review said this and they still called it wrong or whatever. They just never even got a chance to look at it.
Well, that's the administering of the game. If you think of the refs if you think of the refs as administrators of the game, it looks like they failed there, and I don't understand why they wouldn't be able to go back and do something. I mean, it's obviously too late now, but at the time, it's sort of – I wish there was almost like an ombudsman for the refs that could be like, hey, you guys really just kind of screwed up on that call about a minute ago, so can we do something about that? Like, they need to have somebody alert them in some way. I guess other than the coaches and
that's an
players
interesting
yelling
concept,
at them,
actually.
But.
Yeah, you know, somebody in their league office, whether that's in New York or wherever it is, looking at it and saying, hey, buzz down to the arena. You guys need to stop play and come over here.
We have
right
a problem.
Now. Yeah, let's discuss a little bit more about national anthem. It's certainly been a hot topic in sports, starting with Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the national anthem during some preseason games. And it's really... grown since then. I guess right now the question is it just kind of there? Is the controversy getting any bigger, smaller? We've seen some local teams around here deal with it in different ways. One that comes to mind was Millikan University in Decatur, Division III football program. They had voted as a team that to avoid any issues, they would simply stay in the locker room until the national anthem was over. But there was one player on their team who felt strongly enough about it to come out of the locker room and stand on the sideline while the national anthem was playing.
I didn't realize that was a local guy. I've seen that.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, just from Millikan University in Decatur. So that's one example of it, of the issue still bubbling here in our area. But what's your perception of this, guys? I mean, I'm still seeing some protests and things happening, but they don't seem to be getting maybe as much attention as they did.
I think my area of interest, I have not noticed as much. I mean, I noticed, again, during the National Women's Soccer League season, Megan Rapinoe was taking a knee, and that was big news. And she's a really highly visible player in that sport, so it was a big deal. But my area of interest really is in younger players, i.e. not professional athletes, players that maybe don't have as much agency on their team to take a stand in that way, whether they're in college or even high school. I know, and we'll post a link. A friend of mine sent me a link to activities in Seattle high schools where it wasn't just the players who were taking a knee or not participating, but cheerleaders, band, other entities that were associated with the sports in high school. And I think, okay, yeah, that's Seattle. I'm not sure how that would go over here or in other parts of the country. So I plan to do a little more research, and actually if there are people out there who have more information about what kinds of things are happening in their area, you can always tweet us at bandwagon, no consonants, and let us know and point us to articles, because I'm definitely interested in especially that. I think professional athletes, they can do what they're going to do. And it sounds like the NBA in particular may have some plans in this regard in terms of how to deal with the anthem as their season gets underway. But I am definitely interested in like young people and how they make those decisions. There's family that is a part of the decision. It's their coach. It's their teammates. There's just a lot there. So,
yeah, I'm not quite sure what the chances are of local high schools or middle schools, or if they're playing some kind of rec league or something. I don't know how much of any of those kind of protests is actually going to happen. I could speak a little bit just on the NBA side, which is the NBA is generally considered to be a little more forward-thinking than the NFL.
In general?
Than the NFL,
general, though, like
yes.
Right.
Overall.
Right.
Okay.
And so I'm not surprised. And this is a slightly different topic that I'll just mention really quickly. For instance, the NBA moving the All-Star game out of Charlotte, moving it to New Orleans. That's a good example of the kind of proactive, I guess, work that they are doing in order to make sure that they feel they represent their players and their fans. I don't see a whole lot of players kneeling or making a really big deal of the anthem during the anthem at NBA games. I sent you guys a link to, or just asked that you Google David West, who plays on the Golden State Warriors,
mm-hmm.
And is more known for his time when he was a New Orleans Hornet. He has been standing behind the anthem line, he said, by a couple of feet for a number of years. And I don't even know what that means. I'm not sure how long he's been doing that. It has been 10 years. But he felt that he has a lot of things with which he does not agree with in this country. And so he has sort of been doing that in his own little somewhat silent form of protest. And so I don't see a whole lot of other people acting in that way. But the season really starts tonight. We'll have probably 12 games on the slate tonight.
Okay, it is rivalry time, and we're making the new guy pick the rivalry this week. Travis Tate, what do you have for us?
My rivalry is related to those Midwest NBA teams that mm-hmm. we talked about earlier. And that would be the rivalry between the Milwaukee Bucks and the Chicago Bulls of the NBA.
I love the name, the I-94 rivalry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's always an interstate.
Exactly.
I love that. And Cardinals is the 55.
Right.
I-55.
And there's the I-57, mostly between like Illini Northwestern or something.
Yeah.
So
it's good.
It is good.
So I guess I just wanted to bring up those two because it's sort of an under-the-radar rivalry, and it's interesting in one way a little bit more than maybe other rivalries are. Typically, you, with any kind of rivalry in any sport, you'll find when you go to the home team's arena, if you go to Busch Stadium in St. Louis, you're going to find a number of Cubs fans. If you go to Yankee Stadium in New York, there's always certainly going to be a fair number of Red Sox fans and vice versa for both of those. But it's sort of a one-way rivalry in this one. So Bulls games typically sell out. They've sold out since the Jordan era at the United Center. Everybody, it's just always packed. Milwaukee fans are not going to be able to really get tickets in order to go to those games. However, when the Bulls play the Milwaukee Bucks in Milwaukee, which, as we mentioned, is just right up the road. It's like, an hour away or something from Chicago. Bulls fans raid Milwaukee and sort of take over half the crowd. And when I was sort of pitching this to you guys, it sort of reminds me of the crowd at the Illinois-Missouri basketball games, the bragging rights game, where it's like half and half. So those games in Milwaukee are pretty fun to kind of watch and observe, and they played against each other in the playoffs a couple of years ago, and Dwayne Wade went to, you know, Dwayne Wade, NBA superstar, is from Chicago, but then he went to Marquette in Milwaukee, and then now he's back on the Bulls. Jabari Parker was a superstar high school player when he played with Simeon. He then played at Duke and was a really high draft pick, and now he's on Milwaukee. So he's sort of a local kid who's in Milwaukee. So they sort of have some connections there, and then plus the two teams just made a trade about a week ago, so it's kind of interesting.
Wow.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And in some ways what you're describing, I'm not as familiar with the Bulls-Bucks rivalry, but it sounds similar in some ways to what the Cubs and Brewers have.
Yeah.
You know, I think it is a little bit easier for Brewers fans to get tickets at Wrigley during the regular season.
There's so many games.
Yeah, there's so many games that where you probably will see a few more Brewers fans at Wrigley when Milwaukee and Chicago play. But definitely up in Milwaukee, a lot of Cubs fans make that trip up there. And so it may not be quite 50-50, but you always have a sizable Cubs contingent up there at Miller Park too.
Yeah, that's a good point. Those two cities are very different, I guess, in those ways, just because Chicago is such a sports crazy town. They've got, you know, multiple teams in every sport, and Milwaukee does like to claim Green Bay as being their football team. I'm not sure how far away that is. I mean,
a couple hours
far,
at least.
But,
sure.
But they claim it for
it's
sure.
It's all they got.
Yeah, right.
It is Wisconsin's pro football team.
So,
exactly.
And Madison will be like Bucky. You know, that's kind of their thing.
And I think back in the day, the Packers actually used to play like one or two regular season games in Milwaukee at Old County Stadium. I think that was a thing they did for a while anyway, but they don't do that anymore, and they haven't for quite a while. But I was kind of looking when you sent this at I'd kind of forgotten that, you know, the Bulls and Bucks have had a few testy playoff series over the years. I was reading an article you sent over by Sam Smith, of course, the former beat writer for the Tribune, talking about a series, I think it was in 1990, and the Bulls ended up beating the Bucks 3-1, but it was like there were guys getting ejected. There were players being body slammed in the series and guys getting elbowed in the face, like, and all sorts of crazy
stuff. Pro wrestling match?
The immortal Brad Lowhouse, part of that Milwaukee Bucks team.
Oh, boy. Wow. Going back there.
Back in time.
Yeah, I mean, they have that sort of – and we were talking about this earlier with a general sort of Midwest feeling. That is sort of typical, I would say, of – those teams around that era. You know, you throw Detroit into that, of course, with the Bad Boys, and that's just a really great mix of teams and personalities from a very specific time where you could throw elbows at somebody's face and we didn't have to worry about concussions or anything like that.
It was just boys being boys, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of an accepted part of the game.
Concussions didn't exist before, like, 3 years ago, right?
Yeah, exactly.
From what I know.
Yeah, and I'm reading here, too, about, like, back in the Kareem era. Like, and the Bulls were that
era. Alcindor.
Yeah, yeah. The Bulls boys, so to speak, of the NBA at that time, they were a very physical team. Jerry Sloan was one of the guards on that team, very hard-nosed player. And so it was kind of the Bulls were trying to take – it was kind of like the Kareem rules back then, where they were just trying to beat up Kareem and Milwaukee and kind of turn the game into a kind of a slugfest. So the roles were kind of reversed from what we saw later on with Michael Jordan.
Yeah, they became the glitz and glamour, but their makeup is certainly built in that pat. The Jerry Sloan thing is totally true. He's a – revered character there, and obviously in Utah as well when he was coach, but definitely as a player as well.
It's that Midwestern grit and grind coming back a little bit. Yeah. You know? So very cool.
Yeah. So what about the two teams right now? Like, as you look at the Bucks and the Bulls here for this season, the Bulls, you know, signed Dwayne Wade and made a couple of acquisitions. You mentioned in the recent trade they made with the Bucks. So how do those two teams line up this year?
Let's see. Well, Milwaukee, I follow Milwaukee pretty closely the last handful of years. They've become one of my favorite teams. They had a sort of devastating injury happen at the shooting guard position. A guy named Chris Middleton, who even a lot of NBA fans might not be totally aware of, but he's probably one of the most underrated players in the league, especially at his position. Very good offensively and defensively. He's a good shooter. And they lost him for basically the whole year. So that's really going to hurt him. They do have Jabari Parker, who I mentioned, who's from Chicago originally. But their best player is Giannis Antetokounmpo, who is a Greek kid, I would still say. I think he's only like 21 or 22. He signed a 4-year, $100 million contract extension. He's in their plans. He's very, very, very good. So their future in Milwaukee looks a lot better than probably the future in Chicago, just because Chicago did sign those older players. They might be better this year. Wade had a really good year last year, and he might be really good again this year. They got Rajon Rondo, who I think is from actually Louisville, maybe. Hmm. He went to Kentucky, but he's been an NBA superstar for a while. And then they have Jimmy Butler, of course, and they've got a number of other guys. And they got Fred Hoiberg, who most NBA experts I've read say that he's the guy on the hottest of seats to open the year. Like, if you had to predict one guy to get fired first, it could potentially be him.
Interesting.
And so those teams seem to be going in different directions right now, but at this current time, they're sort of overlapping in kind of a 8-10 seed in the Eastern Conference, where I don't think either one of them are going to be particularly good this year.
So, but they could be teams battling for a playoff spot at the end of the season.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They could both be fighting for the same spot. They might, you know, there could be a situation where they somehow meet in the first round of the playoffs or something. I don't see that happening, but it's definitely possible. And any of their matchups this year are going to be hard fought, not only because of the playoffs and stuff, but I think because of these sort of intermingling of all these players. And like I mentioned, that trade that happened earlier, Tony Snell for Michael Carter-Williams, they just did a one-on-one trade there, which I thought was interesting. You don't really see that a whole lot in pro sports anymore.
Yeah, especially with teaming your own division.
Right, yeah. And usually, I mean, even when you do that in your own division, there's always like a second-round draft pick in the year 2050 that you're just going to throw in there somehow. But yeah, this was just a straight-up one-on-one.
So wait, I have one more question about this rivalry, if I may.
Sure.
That has nothing to do with players, stats, et cetera. I heard a piece on the radio this morning about how Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner and Ohio Governor John Kasich have a sort of a mutual bet going on. Does anything like that happen with the their mutual bet is happening because of the World Series, obviously. But does anything like that happen between Milwaukee and Chicago? Like, are there ever political figures?
That's a really good question. I bet they did something for that playoff series a couple years ago. I'm not aware of it, but I wouldn't be surprised at all since they're so close. And you know, maybe it would even be like the congressmen who are like directly next to each other,
or the two mayors, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah, the mayors. I could definitely see
that happen. And if not, then I'm going to look into it. We just gave them a really great idea.
Yeah. I'm going to look into that.
Very good. So that's our rivalry this week, the Bucks and the Bulls. Thanks a lot, Travis.
Thanks, Travis.
Thank
you. All right. It's time for our social media segment, which we are now calling Status Update.
And that name is fluid. If anybody can think of something better, please be my
hashtag,
guest.
Hashtag.
Yeah. Which actually might be better. But for now, we're going to call it Status Update. And as long as I'm talking, I'll go first.
Absolutely.
So I was going to... So in one day I found like the worst thing on social media that I've seen that just made me grumpy and angry, and then also the best thing on social media. The worst thing had to do with the Harvard soccer team, men's soccer team, ranking the Harvard women's soccer team. And I'll post a link to it, but I don't really feel like talking about it right now. Needless to say, it was awful. It was reported in the Harvard Crimson, so it's coming from the school itself. What I thought was interesting, here I am talking about it, and I said I wasn't going to talk about it. What I thought was interesting about the Harvard Crimson article was that there were only three comments on it. Jezebel got a hold of it, Jezebel.com got a hold of it, and there's hundreds of comments, many of which are not safe for work. So, but just so people know if they go listening or go looking, I will post a link to it. But anyway, that depressed me. But that was followed shortly thereafter by, I believe it was Bleacher Report's reminder to me, and it was news to me, that Will Ferrell had gone on Jimmy Kimmel's show and brought back his Harry Carey impression.
Very good. Yes.
Very
and
good.
It was brilliant. It put me in a much better mood. I'm a longtime fan of Will Ferrell's Harry Carey from back in the golden ages of TV, I guess.
All those day games.
Oh,
man. I think he just had to fill a lot of time. He was the master.
God, yes. I mean, he just – the last time Will Ferrell did that impersonation for TV or impression for TV was a long time ago, to the best of my knowledge. He looked great. He had all the details down. He sounded the same. He interrupted himself constantly. It was genius. And so we'll definitely post a link to that. But yeah, that made my day. So that's my social media status update.
Wonderful. I'll go next. And, you know, as a Cubs fan, obviously, I've been just following all sorts of Cubs things here for the last week. I mean, especially since the Cubs won the pennant and they're in the World Series. One of the coolest things was that late last week, and I think it was kind of around – it was around the time that the League Championship Series was wrapping up, but there had really been no inclination that young Cubs player named Kyle Schwarber, who's been hurt all year long, there was no inclination that he was going to play again for the Cubs this year. He had torn his ACL in April in a game, like the third game of the season, I think it was, in Arizona. And, you know, rehab for that injury takes minimum 6 months, and that's basically just to kind of get back to where you're working out again. To even be playing shortly thereafter is almost unheard of. Well, there started to be some buzz last week because Kyle Schwarber was added to the roster for what they call the Arizona Fall League, which is where teams send some of their top prospects each fall for a handful of games against other top prospects. It's just kind of a way for those players to get a little extra work. The Cubs added him to that roster, and that got people thinking, well, hey, why are they doing that? They wouldn't be just adding him to that roster for no reason. Could he possibly play in the World Series? Well, he went down and he played, and I think maybe two or three games in the Arizona Fall League, the last one being on Monday. And sure enough, Tuesday morning, the day of the World Series, the Cubs announced that Kyle Schwarber had been added to the 40-man roster. And so, you know, Cubs Twitter was just going nuts with all sorts of accounts just going crazy. And what does Kyle Schwarber do last night? He's facing two of the best pitchers in the American League, and Corey Kluber, starting pitcher, Cy Young Award winner a couple of years ago, and Andrew Miller, best relief pitcher in the American League, who the Indians got in a trade this year. Schwarber hit a double off the wall in his second at bat against Kluber, hardest hit ball off Kluber all night, that missed being a homer by about 2 feet. And then against Miller, he looked really good, even though Miller's a lefty, Schwarber's a lefty. That's usually not a good matchup. He looked really good in the box against him, took a walk his first time up, ended up striking out in a situation in the eighth inning against Miller. But I think everybody was surprised, one, that Kyle Schwarber's playing in the World Series, and two, he actually looked like a really good major league hitter after not playing against anyone for 6 months. So that's my status update for today.
That's amazing. My status update also stays with the Cubs. I guess they're even infiltrating my Twitter feed, which I don't much appreciate as a Cardinals fan. I have to sort of do the plug my ears and say la, la, la whenever people are talking about the Cubs. I don't want to hear about it. But I do think it's super interesting that this guy, Michael Lee, who was a high school student in California in 1993, yes. 1993, yes. Predicted that the Cubs would make the 2016 World Series. I think he said something like count on it or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that picture has been making its way throughout Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and everything. And so I just thought that was such a strange prediction to make in 1993. Because
random.
He just picked a random year and he happened to get it right. I love it.
Also, some of the parallel, not related to this sort of, but some of the parallels with Back to the Future. I know, they said something like the Cubs win the World Series in 2015.
That's why everybody last year was going nuts.
And there's also some Trump stuff like happening. Like, you know, yeah, it's just, I find that interesting. You'll have to send that to me so I can get it up into our show notes.
Sure.
Very good. So that's our status update for this week. And I think that's a wrap.
It's a wrap, which means it's time to read the credits.
Yay.
Thank you for joining us on the bandwagon. Super thanks to Travis T-Dog Tate for helping host and to Jill Gangler for letting us ask her about her feelings, her Cubs feelings. So thank you, Jill and Travis. Today's Bandwagon podcast was produced by Brian Moline, Lisa Braltz, and Travis Tate. John Steinbucker has been marked absent. He's been absent before. He got sick that one time, remember? And Travis was here for that, too. So yeah, I don't know, man. Come on, John. There are other people who have helped make Bandwagon a thing. Scott Cameron, Jim Kelly, Mike Bowman, Taylor Judd, and the band R.E.M. circa 1985. Who remembers the 80s in this room?
Me.
Yeah, not Travis, though. I didn't think so.
How was that the 1989 Final Four?
How
old were you?
5. I was there, though. I went up in the Space Needle.
Ah, super cool. We'll have to ask you about that sometime. I would also like to take a second to thank the Kick Butt Young Women on the Urbana, Illinois Park District soccer team that I coached with my husband this fall. Big ups to Izzy, Megan, Abby, Emma, Ashley, Alyssa, Annika, Fia, Lena, Paradise, Michaela, Tiana, Alexis, Brianna, Katie, and Alex on a solid season. Park district sports are an important part of our communities. Folks, please lend them your support however you can. End PSA. You can find us on the web at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon. We have links and show notes and videos, and you can subscribe to this podcast and rate it in iTunes. So do that rating thing because it really does help people find us. Follow us on Twitter at Bandwagon Podcast, all consonants, all the time to get our most recent thoughts on stuff. And we all have our own Twitter accounts. You can follow each of us as is your want. We love questions, links, and recommendations, so bring them. We will be back in a couple of weeks, probably with John, but who knows, with a brand new episode. So until then,
sayonara.